Hi, everyone. I'm Esther, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Esther.
Hi, really nice to be here tonight with everybody. I've never been to this meeting before. And what I want to share in this 10 minutes, I guess, is...
Stand up.
Oh, should I stand up? Do they? I'll stand up.
Why?
My story, and just in a nutshell maybe, is I started drinking really young, like as a teenager, 12, you know, was when I was already... And I've heard so many stories in these rooms where we're just super uncomfortable adolescents. I was one of those kids that just was lost in a lot of pain. And that as soon as I found alcohol, I was actually 10 when the first time I got drunk. But by the time I was 12 and 13, I was drinking and stealing alcohol. And I got into drugs. But as always, alcohol was my thing. And to just make this really brief, I got kicked out of the house at 15, and I was out on my own, and I never went back, and I dropped out of school, and I was one of those kids, you know, those really lost kids, and somehow I managed to, through a lot of lying, like I put on from that the minute you know, I left my family so young, and dropping out of school, I had to put on this facade that I was old, and I built a life of lies, and I would function during the day just to put, you know, make sure I was had a place to live, and I did do some couch surfing and things like that at the beginning, but I created a life, another identity from a really, really young age. And every day I would sort of, I'd stay sober during the day, and I worked. I had this amazing work ethic I think I got from my family. Somehow I did that, but the minute, by 3 o'clock from the time I can remember, I started thinking about what I had at home, so that when I got home at 5 o'clock, there was enough there. If there wasn't, I knew where to go and get it. And I didn't like to really drink with coworkers because I would a little bit, but I couldn't wait to leave because I was even so uncomfortable drinking with coworkers. It was like I always just wanted to get home to my bottle to drink the way I wanted to drink, was to drink to pass out. And that was the life I lived for 40 years. I mean, I got sober in my 10th year now. And... it was, you know, and a lot, there was marriages in that, and, you know, I'd marry people to try to fix my alcoholism, marry straight people that were, you know, didn't have a problem, and then I had to kick them out because they got in the way of my alcohol. I've hurt a ton of people. I've hurt myself more than anybody from this disease of, you know, to me was like isolation and shame. It was a huge shame-based thing for me, and I kept repeating behaviors with my alcoholism that kept building that shame. So my self-esteem was just going lower and lower and lower. But I like had two lives. During the day I could work and keep it all together, but I was just, you know, I was a drunk every night privately and kept up this facade for so long until I started falling apart, and my drinking started escalating, and I just found myself going to the fridge. This is where it got to at the end. Standing there, I couldn't hardly get the vodka into the glass anymore. I just would be standing at the fridge and just going in, and I would just pour it. Oh, you know, and then another one, just down. You know, my husband would be somewhere, I was sneaking and trying to pretend I'm cooking, and then another one, like just sneaking and taking the bottles out, and all like the obsession of alcohol. You know, that's what I like to remember it, because I couldn't stop for anything. Like I also tried all those years. To manage my drinking. I've got journals from the beginning of time that, oh, my drinking's too much. Did it ever occur to me to go to AA? Never. I don't, you know, it's really bizarre that I never, I wanted to, I was so shameful, and I went to therapists and all that kind of stuff, but I never focused into my alcohol until, you know, just as 10 years ago. But anyway, the alcoholism, just like what I've learned now from being in recovery for a while, like it really took off to an ugly place, and it scared the shit out of me. Like I was getting really sick, and my body was getting really sick, my liver. And I checked myself in to get some help, and that person, you know, she was a specialist in addiction. I worked with her for a while because I didn't want, and she was the one who got me to go to AA, but I wouldn't go to AA because I was still too good for AA. Like that, you know, I wasn't going to do that. And then she finally said, you know, I think you have to do MPI. Like, and that was just a huge step to go, you know, into rehab for all of us. It was just huge. Like me, like I'm an alcoholic. Like I still, you know, it just kind of blows my mind what it takes, the denial of the disease, the obsession and the denial of the disease and how deep it is. I just, you know, I'm still just, you know, flabbergasted at the depth of the grip that it had on my life. And thank you. And so I went through MPI, and that really, really helped me to get the education I needed to help me deal with shame. And then from there, you know, they guided me to AA. And then I got into AA, and I found a sponsor. Like, the first day I went, this wonderful woman that just, like, you know, I still, you know, I'm still so grateful to her, because she was really hip and funny, and she had a lot of attitude. She was sassy, and she made it fun. And I was just like, oh, okay. Like, I just thought it was the end of my life to go to be sober. I didn't know how to be sober. I didn't even know what fun or communication was or anything, because I always had to do it drunk. And anyway, I was really lucky to meet this beautiful person, and she took me through the steps, and, you know, and I haven't left the community. I mean, I've stayed here, and what I've learned at the beginning was still, I didn't know, you know, we don't know much about AA. I didn't know anything about it. None of it makes sense at the beginning. You're like, what? I mean, whatever, you know, your brain, my brain wasn't even working to even digest what steps are. You know, my brain wasn't working, you know, properly, and it's taken a really, you know, it's still, my brain is probably permanently damaged, but I think the thing that I'm finding is that how it deepens if we keep coming in here and being with our people, right, this community. That was another thing I really suffered from. I didn't know how to bond with people when I was alcoholic. And I was very alone, and I made a geographic to come here. I'm not from here. I left my country. I left my family. I ran away. Like, the shame and the, you know, the disease just takes us away. Like, where I was not rooted. I didn't belong anywhere. And then I had no idea that in AA, I would also feel the sense of belonging. That was part of that deep core emptiness that I drank over. You know, all that internal stuff that we have. I mean, it's complex. And anyway, I just knew that I had to stop drinking, because, you know, I was gonna, you know, what happens when we die, or, you know, shit starts to really happen. And now what I'm just finding is how much I love this community, like, and the people we have, my friends, the friendships, you know, the sponsoring and being sponsored and the network. Like, I've learned how to be part of something, to be in the middle of the herd and feel worthy of belonging, and I get to learn how to act worthy. I didn't know how to do that. I used to do all kinds of shit to people, you know, because I didn't know how to behave. I still have to learn. And so that's why, you know, I love this program. I just love how it works. I still don't really know how it works, but something about it does, and I always feel really good, you know, whenever I'm with all these beautiful people and all of us share this story of recovery, and that we've gotten a reprieve from that disease, like that I don't obsess. I no longer think at 3 o'clock how much booze is in my fridge. I can't believe that's gone. I mean, how did that go? And it is from the steps, from higher power, all those things that didn't make sense. And still, sometimes they're so kind of esoteric. You're like, well, whatever, but I don't question it. It's work. The obsession's gone. I'm learning every day how to be a better person and how to connect. And, you know, my life is just way richer and more meaningful. And so I just encourage anybody that's new to, you know, just do what people told me. It's so simple. And my brain was really muddled, too, at the beginning. And it was like to just hear, keep coming back. It's all these repetitive things. But there's a reason, I think, is our brains just need this simplicity. Keep coming into the room. Get a sponsor. You know, pray. Find all this stuff. Our brain kind of needs that structure for a while. And, I mean, anyway, that's, I think, some of the secrets about how it works, and getting involved and being in the middle of the herd and letting people love you until you can love yourself, you know, but we are all here for each other, and it's pretty magical. And thanks for the opportunity to speak.
Hi, I'm Terry. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
And I'm also a drug addict and several other things. I think you guys know about the glass half full and the glass half empty. I know these two do. You know, the pessimist sees the glass as half full, and the optimist sees it as half full, and the pessimist sees it as half empty. The alcoholic just goes, are you going to drink that? Somebody told that at the meeting this morning. You told it a lot better than I did. But anyway, I got sober on February 10th, 1996. In Maui, Hawaii, of all places, a great place to drink and a great place to get sober, too. And in the end, I was drinking at a place called the Sly Mongoose in Lahaina, Maui, and the industrial section, and it had no windows, and it had no windows. It was a total blackout bar with a few lights in it and some drunks in there, drunks and drug addicts sitting in there all day. And that's where I drank. And when somebody opened the door, the light would come in, you know, and you'd just be, oh, God, you know, close the door, you know. There were no, like, umbrellas in the drinks in there. And one time a tourist came in, a tourist couple, you know, and they'd heard about this bar. Oh, my God, you know, they had to be alcoholics. But anyway, they came in and they bought us all drinks, so we loved them. But that was the only time I ever saw any tourists in there. And that was towards the end, you know. But I started out, it started out much earlier. You know, I had a lot of years of having fun doing drugs and drinking, and I had a lot of years of fun doing that. And then at the end, it wasn't fun anymore. And I was, I felt alone, and I felt like, you know, what's it all about? You know, is this all there is? And that kind of thing. And, but what happened for me is I had a government intervention. You know, the feds and the local cops busted down my door and took me away, and IRS agents too. But anyway, so I got busted. I went to, I had two felonies. I had two busts, two felony arrests, and I had, I was going to court in Contra Costa County and in Alameda County. And one of the places I was going to court, you know, I would show up at court drunk and stoned every time, and I was always late, you know, and they had these big, you know, court things for me, you know, and I'd be there late, and, you know, the both judges told me, look, if you can't get here on time, we're going to remand you back into custody, you know, and I was out on, the first time I was out on my own recognizance, and on the second one I was out on bail. So the first one is one morning I get a call and it's my lawyer and just, where are you? You know, and I go, oh shit, I thought it was tomorrow, you know? And so I get up and my wife at the time, we jump in the car and we're driving through the tunnel to go to Contra Costa County. And I tell her, go to the hospital, I'm gonna have a heart attack, you know? So we drove to the hospital, and I'm having a heart attack. I went, you know, so that the judge would know that the reason I was late was because I was in the hospital, right? So that was kind of the deal. So I faked this heart attack, and I'm in there, and they go, we have to keep you overnight, you know. And I'm cool, you know, great, you know, and have to keep you under observation. So I go up, and they ask me my name. And I give him a fake name because I don't want to pay the bill, you know. So I give him a fake name. So the whole point of going to the hospital so that the court would know I was there was kind of lost, you know. And the thing about that is that made sense to me until I was about 2 years sober. And I didn't think that I was in, you know, I had a problem with that thing about being returned to sanity. And then I thought of that and I went, boy, that was pretty crazy, you know? And it was the first time I'd even thought that, oh yeah, I gave him a fake name, you know? And they didn't call, so apparently my attorney smoothed it over well enough that they didn't call the hospital or anything because I wouldn't have been there, you know? But so then I'm going to court in Oakland and I arrive late and I'm drunk and I'm high. And I come in, and the judge remands me into custody. And the bailiff comes over and goes, empty your pockets. And I pull out this pack of cigarettes with, like, a couple grams of coke in it. You know, oh, fuck, I forgot, you know. And I'm like, it was too late, you know. And the bailiff looked at me like I was crazy. I was crazy, you know. But so he takes it, and then I, you know, I go back, and my attorney comes back, and I go, how are we getting out of this one? And she goes, what do you mean we? And then she says, I go, there's got to be a loophole here somewhere, you know. And she goes, Terry, you handed the cocaine to the bailiff in front of the judge. There aren't any loopholes, you know. So then I went back into the holding cell, you know, and all my peers in the holding cell were all laughing at me, you know. And I thought it was the worst thing, you know. I just, you know, I was, it was, you know, the worst thing. I thought it was the worst thing that ever happened. It turned out to be probably the best thing, because I was on a suicide mission, man. And I'd had two code blues, two emergency deals, and drug overdoses, and I mean, it was just getting crazier and crazier, and the spaces in between near death were getting shorter, you know. And so I like to say it was a government intervention, because it got me off the streets and got me in a place where I couldn't hurt myself, really. It got me into jail. So, and I got sentenced, you know. And I went to San Quentin for the intake thing and sat in a cell for 22 hours a day. And my first cellmate, you know, we were having a really good time, you know. he had tobacco, so we were smoking, and we were in the cell, and we're telling stories, and it's about 3 or 4 in the morning, and we're laughing, and I go, so what are you in here for? And he goes, torture murder. You know, and he goes, what are you in here for? And I said, never mind, you know. So the thing about that was, I had a chance to, I didn't drink the Pruno while I was in there. I tried to score once, and that didn't work out very well, because I got threatened, and, you know, because the money didn't get to the guy, you know, you wire the money to the guy and to the guy's girlfriend or whatever on the outside, and it didn't get there. And so they were going, you're dead, man. You get to, you know, they're telling me they're going to, you know, I'm going to be dead and stuff. And I'm like, shit, what happened to the wire transfer, you know? But anyway, we found out, and got the money got to him. And I said, I kind of chose at that point that I think I'd rather live than die, you know? And so I didn't have any drugs or alcohol while I was in jail, in prison. And so it's coming up to my release date. And when you get released, they give you a couple $100, you know. I don't know how much they give you today. This was a long time ago. But at that time, they gave you $200. And so, and I had about $600 or $700 on the books. So I'm going, okay, I'm going to get out. I think what I'll do is I'll just go party for a few days. I'll go to the bar, maybe score some drugs, party for a few days, maybe get together with some, you know, lady or something, and then party. And then after that, I'm going to quit and get my life together. That was my plan. If you're new, that's not a good plan. And what happened was, I had to do, Contra Costa County came and got me, and I had to do 6 more months over there. So I was taken to Contra Costa County, and they had a little rehab thing that they were doing there, because they wanted to see if they could cut recidivism, you know. And so I thought, my scheming mind, I'm like scheming on this thing, and I go, I'll go over there and play like I have a drug and alcohol problem, and I'll get in that program, because then I could get out sooner, right? So, because I wasn't an alcoholic or a drug, you know, I was so far in denial, it's just ridiculous, despite, you know, all the evidence to the contrary. I still didn't think I was a drug addict or alcoholic. And so I went in and I did this little rehab program that they had in there. And what I got out of it was that I was a drug addict. I got that. You know, I said, yeah, I'm a drug addict. And I'm talking to this guy, you know, we're walking around in the yard and I'm talking to this guy and he's talking about, he had 22 DUIs all over the country. One time he came out of a blackout in Colorado in the mountains. He was driving in the mountains in Colorado. He'd started in New Orleans and he'd started like 3 weeks prior. So he had a 3 week blackout, you know, he was telling me about it. And I go, and I'm telling him, I get it, I'm a drug addict. But I said, but I've never had a problem with beer. So that's what I got out of rehab. And if you're new, that's probably not, that's also like probably a false idea that, to think that you're, you know, can just drink beer because I started drinking beer with a vengeance, you know, when I got out. But before that, I started going to AA, and I went to AA for several months, and I don't know, 3 or 4 months, and I stayed sober, and I went to meetings, and then one day I went to see this woman that I knew, and so I go to see her, and she wants to go to the bar, and I go, cool, we'll just go to the bar, I'll have a 7-Up, and you know, she orders a beer, I have a 7-Up. She orders a beer, another beer, I order another 7-Up. She has another beer, and I had a beer, you know, and then I was off and running again. And then I was back, I went back to my drug of choice. I went back to drugs. And so I was being tested for, I was, you know, they were urine testing me for drugs. And I was, And I was on county, let's see, was it? It was state probation, and I was I was on parole from Alameda County, and I was on probation from Contra Costa County. So I was getting double tested, you know. And the guys, when I was in prison, the guys were saying, you might as well just stay here because there's no way you're going to be able to go out there and be double tested. And some guys did do that. They just stayed in, said, fuck it, you know, I'll just do my time because I know I'm going to come back. So anyway, I started a run again, and I went and did my urine test, and of course I failed it. And so like a good alcoholic, I just stopped going to the urine tests, you know? And then I decided to do like what we call in AA geographic, and I went to Hawaii. And in AA we call it a geographic. California called it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. So I went to Hawaii, and I quit. You know, basically I quit drugs. I always say that. I didn't really quit drugs. I did every once in a while. I'd run into, you know, some coke or something, and I'd do it. But basically, I quit buying it, you know. And in other words, I didn't get a chance to do it very often because I wouldn't buy it. So my drinking just went through the roof, you know. It was just like I'm over there, and I'm just drunk, you know, and I had a job. I got a job, a sales job, and you know, and I just drank. And there was a woman in the company I was with that she was in AA, and you know, I'd go to work and I'd have a few beers before I went in, and she'd go, "Have a few beers, huh, honey?" You know, and I'd go, "Yeah, fuck you," you know, and. You know, I told her, well, I don't have a problem with alcohol, you know, and just lied. And anyway, so, and then I'd go to a sales meeting. We'd have to get up early in the morning, and I'd get there, and I'd be hungover and just felt, you know, feeling like hell and feeling like I'm going to throw up and sitting there, and, you know, whiter than I am now. And she'd go, she'd say, "Got a little hangover, honey?" And I hated her, you know. And she had 8 years sobriety. But anyway, it got, you know, so I went to meetings too. And so a lot of this, I was 6 years in and out. From the time I got out of prison till the time I finally got sober, I was in and out. And I was in and out in Hawaii. And I'd get periods of sobriety. And then the day would come when I'd go, I don't want to go to that meeting, you know? I don't even like those people, you know? I don't want to go sit around with a bunch of losers every day. And I'd start, this is how it would start. And then I'd go, I don't need to go to that meeting. You know, screw those people, you know? So I'd start there. And then it would get to where I'd go, well, I don't want to go to this meeting either. I don't like those people either, and they don't like me. They don't like me either, you know? And besides, I'd rather stay at home and watch TV. And this would go on, and then I'd drink and start looking pretty good. And what would always happen was I'd end up back at this bar I went to, the Sly Mongoose, and I'd be drinking again. And then it would get so bad, you know, I'd be on the verge of losing my job because I was in sales. And I stopped liking the people that were buying stuff. You know, and it's hard to sell stuff when you hate the person in front of you that walked in to buy something. You know, you go, you're not going to buy it. What? Get out of here, you know? Don't bother me, you know? And I'd be like that. And the people I worked for, they'd be going, come on, you know? One time, it was in an art gallery. So one time, the owner asked me to, I'm sitting there, hungover, and I'm just sitting, I'm doing my crossword puzzle, you know, because I've scared all the customers out, you know? And she comes down and goes, Terry, can you dust the paintings, you know, dust the frames and stuff. And I look, I don't dust paintings, you know. So they thought I had a bad attitude, you know. And I thought, you know, hey, I'm not here to clean your shit for you. I'm here to sell stuff, you know, and do crossword puzzles. That was the other thing. She was just, you know. So anyway, it came a time when they said, okay, you got to go down to this other gallery where there wasn't, you know, hardly any action. And I'm working on commission, too. So I'm scaring everybody out. I'm not making any money because it's on commission. And so they put me down to the lousy gallery, you know. And so then I had to kind of change my attitude and to get back into the good one. And I'd get back in. But eventually, all this stuff just came to a head. And I went to a meeting in Kihei, Hawaii, called Kihei Morning Serenity. It's at 7 a.m. in the morning. We were just there. And I saw some of the people that were there when I got sober. And, you know, I'm still friends with a lot of people there. And anyway, I went to this meeting, and I saw a guy that had what I wanted. And I'd planned on, there was this one guy I knew didn't do the steps. You know, I knew he'd, and I wanted him to be my sponsor because then I knew, you know, there was all this peer pressure, get a sponsor, you know, so I go, okay, I got to get a sponsor, okay. That guy is the sickest guy in the room. I'm going to ask him, and I know he won't be asking me to do any steps or anything like that. And so I did that one time, and you know, that was one of the times when I drank again. So there was finally this last time, and I went, and there was these two guys that I thought were just the coolest. You know, they were happy, and they were older. They're older than God. They're older than me. You know, one of them was just died. He was about 6 years older than me, and he just died of liver cancer. And so anyway, I went and I asked. I had a girlfriend at the time, and I'd picked out another loser that I was going to go ask, you know. And the guy had like 8 months, and I go, that's the sponsor for me, this guy. Because he doesn't believe any of this shit in here that they're giving us anyway. So he doesn't believe in it. I know he doesn't. He's not going to, you know, buy into, you know. So that was my plan, was to go ask him. And then this woman I was with, she goes, why don't you ask Ole or Charlie? And they were two guys that, you know, had that really had what I wanted. They were funny. They were having a good time. They had nice cars. They had nice places to live and all of this stuff, you know. And they were kind, you know. And so I worked up the courage. You know, asking somebody to be your sponsor, it's kind of like asking a girl to go steady, you know, in high school. You know, it's kind of like, hey, will you be my sponsor, you know. It wasn't easy. So I went up and I asked him, and he said, I'd be honored to be your sponsor. You know, I went, finally somebody knows who I am, you know. But anyways, so I started doing what he told me to do. You know, I believed him. I trusted him. And I didn't trust anybody. You know, after the shit and people I was, after all the crap that I'd done for so many years, I didn't have a lot of trust, you know. So, but I trusted this guy. And he just died about 4 or 5 months ago. He was 93, and there was about 600 people at his funeral on Maui, which is, you know, Maui's not very big, but, so I asked him, and he would always tell me, you know, pray about something, and I'd go, you don't understand, I don't believe in God, and he'd go, well, pray anyway. You know, just do it, you know. And I started praying, you know. And one time was over a resentment. You know, so a woman in the gallery had stolen a client of mine, you know. And this is something that that's commission, that's my money. She was into my money, you know, pocketbook resentment. And I was pissed. And she was a Jehovah's Witness, too. And I thought, those friggin' Jehovah's Witnesses, you know, they steal your money, and, you know, and I just had it worked it up. I was worked up about this woman, and he told me to pray for her, and I go, you know, and I go, pray for her to hit bottom, you mean, you know, so she can get better, you know, and he goes, no, pray for her, just ask God to bless her and help her to do his will. And so I could do that. You know, he didn't ever ask me to pray for her prosperity or anything. With my money, you know, I'm not going to pray for her prosperity. But anyway, so I prayed for her. And this is a resentment that I would have had for life. And I remember I got rid of the resentment. Like, it was just amazing. It was like within an hour, you know, it was gone because she came in and I didn't have it anymore. And then I thought, God, this prayer thing, that it worked, you know? The first time I did it, it worked, you know? Prayed about a resentment, and it worked. Anyway, so I went on, and I was sober, and I came back to Oakland. And when I was in my ninth year of sobriety, my oldest son got sick, and he had a brain tumor. And when I was 10 years sober, he died. And I was there with him. And thank God I was there with him. I got to be there with him when he went. And I got to be there for my other two other kids and for the mother, his mother, who I was divorced from. But so he went, and so I had the obsession to drink and use removed when I got sober. The last time I got, after my last drink, my obsession to drink and use was removed. And so here I am 10 years sober, and about 3 months after he died, I got burnt for some money. And it was from somebody in the program that had a lot of years and moved out of the country and stuff, and I knew I'd never get it back, and I was really pissed. And I stood up, and it was over. It was on the with an email that I found out. So, and I stood up, and I wanted a drink, you know. And I hadn't had that obsession for over 10 years, and here all of a sudden I wanted a drink really bad. And I know now that it wasn't about the money; it was about my son. You know, it was just. It had just been 2 or 3 months, and I just wanted a drink. And what kept me from drinking was the insurance that I built up in here. I go to meetings. I probably go to at least 5 meetings a week, and I do service, and I sponsor guys, and I have a sponsor. And I, one of the things that kept me out was kept me from drinking was I had sponsees, you know, and I didn't want to let them down. I didn't want to do that to them, you know, because at that time I didn't give a shit, you know. I was like, I had the fuck it's, you know. And but something kept me from doing it. And when I think about it, the biggest thing was having those sponsees and not wanting to have to ask one of them to be my sponsor, you know, to go out. And who knows if I ever would have come back. But if I had, you know, I would have been in a position where maybe one of them would have been sponsoring me, you know. So I didn't drink that time. And then when I was, I guess, well, it's been 2015, I guess when I was about 19 years sober, I got married when I was like eight years sober. I got married to this woman in the program, really great woman. I don't know, probably most of you don't know her. Her name was Ruta. She was beautiful, tiny, 5'2", you know, a runner, just a great human being, you know, and a school teacher, and just like a goody two-shoes, like everything that I'm not, you know. She was, we were exact opposites, you know. And so we were married, and we had this great marriage. I loved her. I really loved her, you know, in a way, not the way I used to love women, but in a new way, you know, a way that we learn in here to love people. And that, which means, you know, doing right by them. So we're going along, and then one day she throws up blood in the morning. And so we go to the hospital, and we're in the hospital, and they're checking her out, and they come back, and she has stage 4 liver cancer, and it's spread to her bones and to her brain. And 10 weeks later, she died, and it happened really quickly. What I want to say about AA and that was my home group's Saturday morning in Montclair. It's called Practice These Principles. It's a big meeting. And that meeting, I have a lot of friends, and there's a lot of sobriety in there. And my friends ask me, you know, what can we do? And my default is, oh, nothing, you know, we're okay. And I went against that, and I said, and they asked me if they could help, and I go, yeah. So this is a hard one for me to talk about, but, and one of these days I'm going to be able to do it without getting choked up. But what happened was somebody put up a website, and they had people sign up to walk my dog. When we'd go to the hospital, I left the back door open. It was always open. People knew that. And they'd come over, and they'd clean the house and put flowers out. And they'd come over and just all kinds of ways help me. And it happened for the 10 weeks that we were going through this, that my wife and I were going through this. And then when she was right towards the end, my friend Gail came over and gave her last rites, you know, Lutheran last rites, and because my wife was Latvian and they're Lutheran, you know, and it was just the most amazing thing. It was like, you know, there was this pain of losing her, but there was also just this, like, thank you, God, you know, like, thank you. And so after she died, I moped around, you know. I mean, it's painful losing somebody, and I talked to God, and I said, God, I'm here to do your will, and if you want me alone, I can do that, you know. But if it's your will, I'd like to have another woman in my life, you know. I'd like to have a, and so then I had my eye on this one. You know, I wanted a young one, a young hot one. She's 62, so I'm 71, so I go, boy, a young hot thing like that. So when I was a year and 2 months after my wife passed, I asked her out, and she had a boyfriend, and so, you know, we couldn't go out, and she'd go, I got this guy Dave, you know, and I'm going, oh God, you know, shit, you know, so one day I asked her to chair a meeting for me. I was secretarying, and she came and she chaired the meeting, and then I said, you want to go to dinner, you know, and she goes, okay, and we go. And I go, what's happening with Dave? She goes, oh, Dave, you know, he's still there, but Dave was on his way out, you know. And so eventually, Dave was on kick out, and her and I got together, and it was pretty crazy. You know, I scared the shit out of her. I don't know why, you know, just because I have a couple of felonies, you know, on my record, and, you know. But anyway, she was a little afraid and stuff, but eventually we got together, and I like to tell the story about my Christmas present. The first Christmas, she gave me this really beautiful cashmere coat, you know, that goes down like nice, you know, and she gave it to me for Christmas. It was Dave's. David left it there. So I was wearing Dave's coat around, you know, and I liked it. I go, well, I don't care. It's a nice coat. So, but that's the way she is. She's practical. So, but anyway, I guess what I'd like to say is, just to wrap it up, is that I have had a great life since I got sober. I had a lot of fun drinking and using, but there came to a point where I had no spiritual life. You know, so the material world, there came a point where the material world let me down. I mean, to the point where I didn't care if I lived or died. You know, it's just like, you know, I didn't actively try to commit suicide, but I was ready to die, and I would have been okay with that. And I had no spiritual life. So when I came in here, I had a sponsor that pushed the spiritual part of me, you know, and I was open to it, you know. And so I was open to it, and so I started to grow spiritually. And, you know, that's endless. Spirituality, there's no end to. The material world is finite, and it ends, and it has a beginning and an end. But the spiritual world's everlasting. And there's spiritual principles that we get from the 12 steps. You know, I didn't know that for years. I knew we had these 12 steps, but I didn't get the depth of that. That those 12 principles in those 12 steps are the solution to any and all of my problems. You know, I my wife was going to die, so we both talked about step three. You know, we talked about it, and I, you know, we talked about we have to get into acceptance about this, you know. So one night we're on the couch, and she's really weak, and she's going, and she whispers to me, because she could hardly talk, and she goes, I'm in acceptance, you know, and I went, I'm not, you know, I wasn't, but I worked on that. That was our spiritual work, and you know, anytime I have a problem, I have some spiritual work to do. You know, it's not the problem. You know, the problem's in here, you know, so that's what I have to work on, is in here. You know, when I think life sucks or whatever, you know, I'm just not in acceptance about life, you know, and so I have to work on getting there. And the way I do that is I go to meetings, and I'm surrounded by people I love, and that, you know, gives me security. It gives me all kinds of gifts, you know, being around all my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, and who are also on this path, on this same path of growing spiritually. And I'm still growing. You know, there's, I still have a lot of work to do. And when I don't, when I think I don't, something comes up and bites me in the ass and lets me know that I do. And it lets, and then I can go to the steps and I can go, what is it? Where is it? You know, am I powerless, you know, over something? You know, can I change it? Do I need to accept it? Whatever it is, and it's all there. And part of that's coming to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. You know, and that's, in my opinion, after the second step, three through 12, is getting you to that, getting you to coming to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity. You know, to me, that's what it's all about, is me developing a conscious contact with my higher power. I work at that. It's not always there. A lot of times I get tripped up and I get bogged down in the problem, but usually I can come out of it, you know, because at this point, after 23 years, I can go, where do I need to work? You know, where do I need to go with this? What step do I need to practice? Where am I falling short? Do I need more meetings? Do I need to stick another meeting in here? Do I need to talk to somebody? You know, whatever it is. And it all comes from here. So anyway, and from God, you know, from our higher power who's in here tonight. So thank you.